Okay. Hi, I'm Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. To the grace of God and the program of AA, having a drink to the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. I want to thank Bill for the shirt and Jim for the tie. And I don't know why I thought this was going to be a little bit more casual. And I want to thank Annie for being here with 49 years. My sponsor is going to have 49 years in 2 weeks. And you'd think that those of us, as we come along, would like to have the most sobriety at a conference, but it's really a crappy feeling. One of the reasons I've always liked to be around Alcoholics Anonymous is for the old-timers. I don't like being the oldest. Once in a while, my ego gets in. I like being the oldest person, but mostly it was the attraction of those people ahead of me that kept me coming, and I wanted to listen to. So thank you for your activity and your sobriety. This has been a very cool weekend. I attend a lot of conferences. This is not an average conference. There's a lot of juju in this room. You've had great talks so far this weekend. One of the two most unnecessary talks this weekend will be Peter and mine. You've had a full conference. This is not an average deal. You don't get talks like that. And that comes from the group. We create that together. You don't just create that as a talker. That happens together. Love being here with my friend Don and his wife Jackie. Don helped start this conference, and one of the reasons this conference is here is for a mutual mentor of Don, Fritz, and mine, of Bob White, a man who got sober in August of 1954, like my sponsor got sober in August of 1954, and that man always wanted to have a conference in the mountains, and Don never quite got around to it until about 11 years ago. And so there's just a lot of cool things. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank both of you, David and Jeannie, and this has been cool. Well, we're in a hurry, so I'm not going to go. I took my first drink when I was 13 years old. I was a freshman in high school. I was 4'11". I weighed 95 pounds, and I was the second smallest kid in my high school class. As far back as I can remember, I never liked who or what I was. I always wanted to be something different. Wanted to be bigger, better looking. Wanted to be an athlete, football player. I had a back problem. I had a yellow streak down the back of it, and didn't work out very well. I'm from a large Catholic family. I grew up in St. Paul, Minnesota. We had large Catholic clans. We had, you know, families were friends of families. If you were, you know, there, if you, many families had 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 kids. It was not that unusual. And so if you were friends, you were, you know, your kids went to school for decades, you know, in the thing. It was very cool. And it's still that way. I still see people that I went to grade school and high school with. So it's a big, small town. We live in the Twin Cities, which is, you know, 2.8 million people, but St. Paul's a pretty small place. It's a cool place. My heroes and the people I grew up watching were the Second World War vets that came back that played hard and drank hard. And, you know, Tim is here, and his old man was in AA, you know, back as, I think your father would have close to 50 years today also. Got sober in 56. And, you know, those guys made life look easy. They came by, they raised large families, they were active in their communities, they built businesses, and boy, they had fun. They had, you know, cocktail parties were the order of the day, and that just made life look easy. I never felt like I fit in. I felt like everybody else got to school an hour early, held a meeting, and decided what to do for the day, and I always missed the meeting. And so I'd kind of talk about the meeting, hell of a meeting, you know, hoping you'd discuss what would happen at the meeting. And but it didn't. The best it got is I got to be a marginal member of the in-group. And I got to be that by being what I thought you wanted me to be, but I felt like if I stopped being what you wanted me to be, you wouldn't have me anymore. But one night a friend of mine went out and we split a fifth and my life changed. It was, boy, that was like a sex change operation. It was, I mean, it was not a linear change. It was, you know, an exponential change. It just, all of a sudden, I felt like you looked. I didn't feel like I was a member of the group. I felt like I owned it. I was able to move with a sense of ease and comfort that I have never had before. It was awesome. I went to a military school on a college campus. If you were an underclassman and showed up at a drinking party, which I did my first night with a bunch of Good Be Shining Shoes for 2 years, you know, and I showed up and I, you know, mixed with everybody and had a great time, and I chased booze as hard and as often as a young man could. And I, by the time I finished high school, my drinking problem was the largest subject of negative conversation in our home. I thought I had just poor luck. I thought, you know, my drinking problem was the fact that I was underage. My drinking problem was the fact that I got caught a lot. Just bad luck. I didn't think I drank any more than anybody else. I look back on it, and I just drank more often. You know, I had false ID cards. I was making false ID cards when I was 15 years old. I knew all the joints in town where you could, you know, if you had a suit and tie in those days in the 50s, you could go places. Hell, I didn't reach puberty until I was 40. But, I mean, God, they were serving me, you know, and, you know, at all these different places. But I didn't think I drank differently, but I did. And I got in trouble, and I had a chance to go away to school. I took it. I went away to school. Long story short, I drank my way to the University of Notre Dame, middle of my senior year. I'm the class drunk. I mean, I'm in civil engineering, carrying 25 credits a semester, and I'm going to school 1 out of 10 days. I wake up in the middle of my senior year, and I don't know where my classes are. You know, the bad... That's funny until you become a parent. My wife has stood up. Stand up one more time. Linda is with me. I'm glad that she's here. Without her being an Al-Anon and my being an AA, I don't know if we'd be married today. We've gone through, my story is kind of tacky. I had problems in sobriety. Most of you people have not. I know that you got sober and everything was okay. But my story wasn't quite like that. And the partnership that we've been able to form with her and Al-Anon and me and AA has just been a blessing. That when things are tough, that we've been able to turn the lasers on ourselves rather than each other. Is why we love each other today and why we have a relationship today. And that is most cool. But we have 3 kids who are 34, 31, and 23, who have 15 years, 11 years, and 5 years of sobriety. I have turned my wife in as a carrier. None of us were alcoholic when we met her. All of us are alcoholic now. So it's kind of like Tomaine Mary, I think is what that is. But as I say, when you have our middle boy, that little craphead that went to school at Regis for a semester and went to 6 colleges until he finally got his act straightened out, and he finally got the idea of attending. He was into registering for the first 3 or 4 universities, and then he got this idea of attending, which, hell of an idea. But I was a class drunk. They used my room as a, you know, and I didn't start out to be the class drunk. That was not what I wanted to be. I mean, that was a big deal for me. Notre Dame was wanted to do well in that, and I just ran my string out. I could not drink. And I was, you know, I won't bore you with the stories, but long story short, in the middle of when I walked out of my senior year, I was supposed to be drafted. I was in ROTC, and I was supposed to be an officer in June, and I got a medical release for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19. That seemed impossible. It seemed inappropriate. It seemed inaccurate. I didn't think I had I remember the psychiatrist. I still see the psychiatrist once in a while that diagnosed me, because he'd call me up once in a while, and I'd go see some of his patients. And I just thought he was nuts. I mean, I just thought that was wrong. And he told me, I went down, he referred me to a psychiatrist at Notre Dame. I went to the library, looked up alcoholism, and I got something that was Freudian, and it related it to latent homosexuality. I mean, looking at one issue was enough. Looking at 2 issues when I was 17, I was not up for it. And so I just kind of passed on the diagnosis at that moment. And walked out of Notre Dame, came home, finished school at a local university. And when I finished school, my father asked me to leave home. He said, "We love you and we care about you, but you're just a mess. And good luck." And, But I think of how frustrated, I think of how much my parents loved me and how hard they tried to help me and how much money they spent, how much of the family resources. And just, they were as perplexed. You know, my sister was Phi Beta Kappa. She went to the Sorbonne in Paris. My brother was Phi Beta Kappa in law school. I'm this asshole lodged between these two show-offs. And, you know, seemingly well-equipped, but just never put it together. And that's not, as a parent, I'm telling you, that's not, you know, it's just not cool. It's hard. It's painful. I mean, we shouldn't be related to how our children are doing, but there is something that you want your children to be okay. You know, and I think of how long I, you know, kind of kept them on the hook. But I finished school. I went out, got a job at a liquor store. You have to use your gifts. And, you know, stealing booze in the liquor store. I got a ticket for going 80 miles an hour. I got fired. I got a job as a waiter at a private club. I'm living on, not Skid Row, but $5 a night rooms. I'm living with, shacked up with waiters and waitresses. I'm, you know, Dr. Seuss, that child author. Those are actual photographs of people I live with during the last year of my drinking. It was, I'm drinking a quart a day. I'm getting up at 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. I, you know, drink a couple of beers, take a couple of dextrines. I go to work. Where's the waiter from 11 to 1 or 11 to 2? 2 to 5, I drink beer. 5, I go buy a pint. Somewhere during the day, I figure out who I'm going to live with, and I'm, you know, it's not working. I'm blow, you know, the only symptom of elevation sickness that I have, unfortunately, is bloating. I wish there were. My wife doesn't seem to have that particular symptom, but I do. My life's a mess. It is just absolutely a mess. And I went to a party one night. I got my face kicked in. I got fired. I couldn't serve food looking like I looked. And I went back. I had no place to go. I was tapped. I went back to my family who had not seen me in 6 months, and I begged my way back into the house, on the which was allowed on the condition that I wouldn't drink. When I moved back in the house, I made the largest full court press. I can't tell you how much I didn't want to be me. It would be hard for me to explain. I was the family jerk. I was, you know, you get the look from your mother or you get the look from your spouse. I got the look from mother, spouse, and six siblings. You know, I was, you know, once or twice a year, the police would bring me home, car accident, you know, and my sisters would be crying, my mother would be hysterical, my father would be calming my mother down, my brothers would want to beat the crap out of me, and that would be the family meeting. And that would happen. You were always the subject of the meeting, but you were never a participant in the meeting, and that happened a couple of times a year. I moved back in the house. I really want to change my life, so I figure if I get a job, if I get married, you know, I went with Linda for 2 years before that, broke up with her for almost a year, and then I begged her to reconsider our relationship, and she did, and she had broken up with me for quite some time, but I'd call her just off. I was kind of like a low-grade headache. I'd just call her every so often just so she couldn't forget me, and I got a job as an executive trainee in manufacturing, sure, and brought my first car, and I thought, wow, it's finally going to happen. And finally, all I thought, if I could just become a damn grown-up. You know, I mean, all my parents' friends were all vice presidents or something. They had jobs and families, and I just thought, geez, all I got to do is get to be 35 or 40, and you're going to be okay. And I don't know what the hell is happening to me. And I got this job. I could not stop drinking. Now I'm the company drunk. I'm in a company of engineers. And I'm, you know, I use up my sick leave. I mean, big corporations are tough. They like to have you come in on Mondays and stay on Fridays. They got lunch hours. I'm a mess. I am just a mess. And I quit that job after 6 months. Took a job, sales job, because I thought I needed some flexibility. And I don't know, 3 or 4 months into the sales job, a buddy of mine gets married, and I do about a 4-day or miss 3 days of work, call in the first day, not the second two. I wake up after a blackout. I get into a fight the night before. I got vague memories of what happened at the Stag, and I'm, you know, I don't know if I have a job, a fiance, or a place to live. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my father and my psychiatrist that I call AA didn't seem like such a dumb idea. And I called AA. Got an old-timer down to central office. He called me, and he sent two guys out to see me at a cafe at 5 o'clock, and I went and I met these two guys. After I called Linda and found out I was still engaged, and found out my parents were concerned and I still had a job, and I thought, why the hell did you call AA? You know, just. But I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like. You know, there's no denial in my case, so I was just curious. So I went and met these two guys. And when you're young and in trouble, you get in front of a lot of experts, but you're always a subject. You're never a participant, and they always ask you a bunch of questions. At the end of the meeting, they have recommendations for you. And I thought that's what I was going to get, and it isn't what I got. I got a guy with 6 years and another guy with 6 months. They said, we're from AA. We had a drinking problem. We found an answer in AA. We're here to share it with you. We hope it helps you, but for some strange reason, it helps us when we call on a new guy. So don't worry about it. You know, they weren't getting a toaster for signing me up. It wasn't a multi-level marketing deal. It was just a 12-step call. And those two men, in a matter of an hour and a half, changed my life. They sat me down in the booth and told me their drinking stories. And I had never, up till that time, as much help as I had been exposed to, which has been a lot, I'd never talked or been exposed to another person with a drinking problem, and I found myself identifying and nodding my head and identifying and started to share things as reluctantly as I might have been to share them. And in an hour and a half or 2 hours, they gained my confidence and asked me, that night I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a lot of traditions in AA, one of the most wonderful ones of which is that we share our experience, strength, and hope, but not our ideology, not our philosophy, not our thinking. There is something so powerful when you share your life. Those two men and the sharing of their lives changed my life. I went to my first meeting. It was astounding. I was 23 years old. I was scared stiff. Thought they were going to give me a test, ask me why I was there. I really was scared. I went to the meeting. There were people there that I kind of knew my family, and I was, you know, just goosey as hell about anonymity. I had no idea what was going on, and it was one of the most astounding experiences I ever had. The level of acceptance was phenomenal, and I felt like I was home from the moment I walked in my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The gift that was a gift for me. I've had trouble practicing the principles, but I had never had trouble loving AA. And I have worked with a lot of young people in my first few years, and there were all sorts of people who needed it more than I did. They didn't like AA. They didn't like the meetings. They didn't identify. I mean, what a gift for me from the moment I walk in that I identify and I love you. Makes a hell of a difference that I didn't have that obstacle. What a gift for whatever reason that was. I was scared stiff. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I thought I had, you know, and I knew drinking caused me a problem, but I thought it was symptomatic. I thought if you knew about all the issues of my life, you wouldn't think I was just an alcoholic. You'd understand that there's a lot of complexities. The worst problems I had were cold stone sober. I had problems connecting all the chaos in my life with swallowing bourbon. You told me that if I quit drinking, I'd be okay. I had quit drinking a couple of times. I'd almost died a couple of times drinking, and I had two or three forced periods of sobriety, and the forced periods of sobriety were horrible. I didn't become a perfect student. I never got my life in order. I was just as uncomfortable as I'd ever been in my life. I just thought I was a loser. I had a fair amount of abilities, thought I should be able to perform like my siblings or whatever, and I just never seemed to be able to do it over a period of time, and I just thought I had a built-in failure mechanism. My parents could not understand why it was such an ass, why they would ask me, just don't drive the goddamn car. Just don't, you know, if you're going to just, you know, I had to drive, I couldn't walk, you know, those sorts of things. And but it was as baffling to me as it was to them. I didn't know that when I went out, I took one drink, and the guy that had the one drink forgot all about the conversations that we had before. I was just going to have one drink, smoke a couple of cigarettes, come home. Who the hell know? I really didn't understand. I was told that alcoholism was a disease. It was physical, but also mental and spiritual. I was told that once I crossed the line from problem drinking to alcoholism, my alcoholism affected me all the time, when I drank and when I didn't drink. That was like rocket science. How could alcoholism affect you when you didn't drink? He said, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, drinking's just a symptom of the disease. Also rocket science. I thought we'd spend all our time talking about how not to drink. He said, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, once we take our last drink, our last drug, we use the 12 steps to change. To change sufficiently that you find something that, you know, so that you don't have to go back to booze or drugs or do something for you that you're unwilling or unable to do for yourself. If you don't change, you're going to go back because you don't know how to live sober. I can remember the chair I was sitting in. I have the same sponsor today that when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. That isn't is common today because people move a lot and stuff. Is that a gift? Is that cool? You know? Actually, the same two sponsors. One was kind of assigned to me, and I had never used him much, but the man I asked when I had 30 days of sobriety, I had coffee with the day before I left, you know, to come here. And so I got real active in AA. I drank twice after coming in AA, once after, on a business trip to the West Coast. I was told to call AA. I didn't, and I got drunk, and I got in trouble. Came back. I had almost 3 months of sobriety, and I drank on our honeymoon. I think I had that subconsciously planned, and we honeymooned in Mexico, and you know where the divers dive off those cliffs? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. And this is not pretty, but I went over. I went over. Alemán, the ex-president of Mexico, is there. His nephew had been my roommate my sophomore year. I go over to talk to the president of ex-president. His bodyguards don't think I'm cool. I'm plastered. I take off my Bermudas. I got a swimsuit on. I dive off the public landing, climb up 85, 90 feet. I'm stuck. I'm bleeding. My swimsuit's stuck. Linda's going absolutely nuts. I mean, there was a world's high diving contest there that day. Mickey Wright, refused to dive that day. You know, I mean, the Olympic champion. She's up on the cliffs, but this asshole is up on this, you know. And I'm trying to decide whether to jump or dive. And I'm watching the waves come in, and finally I figured out the hell with it, and I dove. And God watches after fools and drunks as I made it. And if I would have jumped, I would have died. I didn't know. You have to get out almost 30 feet. You can't get out far enough if you jump. You can only get out far enough if you die. I didn't know that. I might have known it intuitively. But, you know, my 10th anniversary, 5th anniversary, we were down there with the kids, and Linda gave me a card that showed a picture of the chasm of La Quebrada, and she gave me it said, "But for the grace of God." And I said, "God, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done." And she said, "Bob, it's not even in the top 10. I don't know how people can share a life and see it so differently. I'm going to do my best to do this. I come home, I get back to the meetings, and I settle down. And I'm 24 years old now by a week, and I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, okay, I'll buy it. I got the problem, you got the answer. And I, you know, for a guy who... blessed because I got sober pretty quick, but I was always Mr. Potential. I had the potential, but I could never actualize the potential. And now I thought, well, hell, if I got the problem and you got the answer, my life finally ought to come together. And it might take a year. It hasn't quite come together yet. If you're here for hope, you might want to take a cigarette break. But for almost a year in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was on a honeymoon. I was as happy and as delighted and as teachable as I've ever been in my life. I asked a question and I got an answer. But I tell you, about the end of my first year in AA, I'd ask a question, I'd get an answer, and I wasn't sure you were right. My ego started to reassert itself. I started to ask, you know, questions. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I wanted was to find an expert on Bob. I wanted someone with so much insight and so much wisdom that they could see through me and tell me why my life was so mysteriously screwed up. And I never found that. I haven't found it yet. What happened to me is I surrendered and I took the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous and I became an alcoholic. When I became an alcoholic, I found experts on alcoholism and experts on recovery. And I had tens, if not hundreds, of teachers in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous who would answer my questions and give me support. After a year of sobriety, my ego reasserted itself, and I started my search for an expert again. And I wasn't so sure. You know, when you have sponsors over a long period of time, you go through some ups and downs. And sometimes you think your sponsor's wonderful and brilliant, and sometimes you think he's not quite as smart as you'd like to have him be, and all those sorts of things. And I went through a number of those with my sponsor, Warren. When I did my first inventory, it was just kind of a recitation of the worst behaviors that I had, and it wasn't very insightful. But during the tail end of my first year and into my second year, I got a pretty good list of my defects of character. And one by one, I kind of took them on. My problems were horrible, but they were ordinary. I couldn't get up in the morning. I later found out that it had something to do with when I went to bed, but at that time I didn't have any idea. I had money problems. I spent $300 or $400 more a month than I made. If you do that over a long period of time, you'll end up in debt. I had marital problems. They weren't. Everybody walks into that union with a different idea of what should go on. Linda's dad was a wonderful gentleman and a guy who came home every night at 5 o'clock. I kind of passed through at 5 o'clock on the way to a meeting, and she'd broil something because all she could do at that time was broil. And I'd go to the meeting early and come home at midnight. She's a nurse, so she's up at 5:30 or 6 going to work, and I'm still in bed. And we're like ships passing in the night. She saw more of me when we were dating than when I was sober. And then we started to have kids, and I had great parents, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes my parents made, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes my parents made in a bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent with my children. I'm not proud of that fact, but that's an accurate description of how it was. As near as I can tell, I'm the fifth generation alcoholic in my family. And I was instrumental in breaking that chain in my family. As near as I can tell, I am three or four generations of inappropriate anger and sometimes physical violence with children. I would love to break that cycle in my family. And I'll tell you something, crap rolls downhill. Your children observe that and experience it. And as wonderful as my father was and what a hero he was, you don't, until your father starts jumping out of your mouth when you become a parent. You don't even know that. You don't even know the conditioning that you have. It was like I had a computer program in the computer and I never put it in, and all of a sudden I became a parent and I plugged in the parent program and my dad starts jumping through my mouth. We are a far less, we are much more conditioned than we would believe ourselves to be in the process of our lives. So I had a gambling problem. It was more of a hobby. 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. So I was making about $8,000 or $9,000 a year playing backgammon. It was kind of like a second job. And I didn't have these problems annually or quarterly. I had these problems daily. I had these problems in my first year of sobriety and never noticed them. The second year, I noticed them. The third year, they're on my inventory. The fourth year and fifth year, they're eating my lunch. My sixth and seventh year, they are killing me. I'm going to 4 or 5 meetings at least a week, maybe 6 or 7 meetings a week. I'm active. I'm doing 12-step work. I'm starting to give talks. I'm active in service. And my life's going backwards. A new guy's coming in the club. I'm giving him a cup of coffee. And he gives me that bushel basket full of cancer that everybody walks in with. And I'm saying, hey, as bad as it is and as hopeless as it seems, it's going to be okay. See that guy over there? God, his life was a mess, and now he's 2 years sober, and he's knocking it out of the park. Just get a sponsor. Get into the book. Try the steps. You don't even do them perfectly. Just try them, and your life's going to be okay. And then I get in the car 11 o'clock at night, drive home, and I say, Bob, when's it going to be okay for you? You're 6 years sober. You just bought a $400 sport coat at a store that you had a $600 bill at. When are you going to quit buying things you don't need with money you don't have to impress people you don't like? And I didn't have an answer. When are you going to learn how to work? You don't know how to work, for Christ's sake. I'd go to work early. I'd leave early. I'd have a 3-hour AA lunch, because anytime, anywhere, the hand of AA reaches out, you want to be there. And, and then I'd go down and play backgammon for the afternoon, and I wasn't doing well. And I didn't know. I said, when are you going to be more gentle with your children? When are you going to be more loving with your wife? When are you going to quit gambling? I didn't have an answer. I'm trying to do all those things, and I'm going backwards. And I'll tell you something. And what I'm going to tell you right now, I know that we're short on time, but this is what my talk's mostly about. So I'm going to do this. And some of the speakers have talked about it here today. I believe that you have more than once. Surrender. I believe that you have more one spiritual awakening. You can't get done what you need to get done to have the full measure of recovery in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 years. You don't need to get it all done in that period of time. Also, what progress you can make, you only need the progress that you're making to stay here. But I'll tell you something. Somewhere between 5 and 12 years, if you're like most alcoholics that I've run into in the program, your pants are going to catch on fire. We come in here with an idea of what we need to do early in our sobriety, and many of us are amazingly facile at accomplishing those things. But most of us have a hell of a lot of other things. Some of the issues, most of us, you don't drink a pint a day or more because your life works, because you know how to deal with life. Most of us didn't know how to deal with life before we drank. And then we, as Donna talked about today, you put the drink, your talk was just wonderful, if you like that sort of thing. Not everybody likes dignity and wisdom and grace and beauty and strength. That was one of the most amazing talks. Very cool. You're just going to run into yourself. You're going to run into things that you have to change that you were never on your list or you never had any idea that you're going to be scared to death of changing because you think to change them is to die. You think it's who you are, and you just aren't going to know what to do. And I started to run into those things in my sobriety, and I didn't know what to do. The thing that has saved my bacon in AA is I love the old-timer stuff. I've always had teachers, and I can't keep my mouth shut, so at least to some degree. I was telling my sponsor about 60% of what was going on. Now, I know in Colorado you do 100, and I want to congratulate you. Don told me today everybody that he sponsors tells him 100% of what's going on. I was only doing 60. You know what? I was only telling myself 60. I didn't have 100. I wasn't up to seeing where my life was at or what was going on. My life was going backwards. I felt like I was on the down escalator going up. I owed as much money in 7 years of sobriety as I did when I came in, and I had paid off all my debts. I'm in trouble at home. I'm in trouble with the kids. I'm in trouble at work. And it's just, you know, I don't know. I'm busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day, and it's just not working. I don't know what, it just, you know. And it is. And I'm, one more time, thinking that I'm a great starter and a poor finisher, and AA worked for you, but it's not going to work for me, and I'm running out of my rope. And it's funny, I know what the answer is. The answer is to find a God of your understanding. My sponsor had that relationship, and the people who I admired had that relationship, but there's a problem with it. The problem is you go knock on the door, God says, who's there? You say, God is Bob, and he says, what do you want? And I said, I want to sign up. I am dying. I am 6 years sober, and my pants are on fire, and I'm dying. I'm ready to check out. I can't tell you, baby. Everybody thinks I'm doing okay. I'm doing terrible. Everybody wants me to go give a talk or get on a committee, and they're telling me what a great AA member I am. I said, I am literally dying. And God says, okay, come on in. And I'm going to say what everybody wants to know. What do I do? Which is always what the sponsors want to know. Wrong question, but it's, what do I do? And you know what God's going to say? Get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. Don't spend more money than you make. Be kind and loving to your wife and be kind and loving to your children. And stop gambling. I mean, you have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that God might have a conversation with me like that. I'm going to say, hell, if I could do all those things, I wouldn't need God. What the hell do you think I've been trying to do for the last 6 or 7 years? So what's the use of developing a relationship with God if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? My idea was, as soon as I clean my act up, maybe I'll have a relationship, but until I do, I mean, it's just nuts. I'm not going to be able to do what God's going to want me to do. And I was stuck in that place for almost 2 years. And I got at the end of my rope, and I'm at the place where you're just, you know, you're flipping a coin, you're either going to commit suicide or call your sponsor. And I am, and I, out of fear of getting drunk, but mostly out of fear of being a sober ass, I was so tired of me. I was so tired of me. And I went back to the steps. I found out what step one meant to me 7 or 8 years sober. Not a very hard deal. Powerless and unmanageable. Clear as glass. You know what blew my mind? Step two. I believe step two for us. You would ask me, do I believe God's going to restore us to sanity? The answer is yes. The needle doesn't move at all. You ask me if God's going to restore Bob to sanity. The answer is no. I'm 7 years sober. I'm going backwards. I'm in trouble in every area of my life. I'm going to 6 or 7 meetings a week. I've gone through the steps twice. I really do care. I really care about what kind of a man I'm in my own life, and it's not working. It's all my life's always like this. I can get the job, I just can't work. I can get in school, I just don't do school. I can get into the church, I just can't do the church. And now I'm in this AA program, and I can't do AA. And I guess when you're in trouble, you go to more meetings, and you see, I was given the gift to all of a sudden see people with bigger problems, with a smile on their face, walking through walls that I was trying to walk around with dignity. And I came to believe that God was going to restore Bob to sanity. I went to my sponsor on my knees, and went to his office, and I took step three. We didn't do that much in those days, and it was awkward and a little embarrassing, but I thought, I'm going to cross the T's and dot the I's. And my previous four steps have been with clergy, which was our custom. But this time I thought I'd do it with my sponsor, and I didn't. When I said, when you're done, be careful. I took a four-step with him, and one of the things he wanted me to do was go to a psychologist. I went to a psychologist, and in the process of going to the psychologist, I made a discovery. No, I'm sorry. I'm just going to tell what happened to me. I went to the psychologist, and what I discovered is that my life was swimming in fear. If you would have looked at my previous three fifth steps, I had, you know, dogs and tall buildings and snakes. You know, I didn't have any insight into the fear in my life. And I can remember the psychologist looked at me and said, "Why are you so afraid of failing?" And I wanted to pull the nose right off his face. I said, "Listen, asshole," I explained. I said, "You're a doctor." I said, "You fail, you know, you just take your little sign, walk down the hall, put it on a different door, and you're making $100,000 within 6 months." I said, "I'm about to go bankrupt. I wonder why." And I said, "I'm going to lose everything I had." I said, "Nod your head up and down if you understand that. I'm going to lose everything I had." He looked at my wife, and he said, "If Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you?" And my wife said, "Nope, wouldn't lose me." Looked at my children, and he said, "If your dad lost everything he had, would he lose you?" And the kids said, "Nope, wouldn't lose us." If you can't lose, you can't play. I've been a guy all my life who can't play. I can't take the risk of failure. So I wouldn't make the sales call. I'd just phony up an activity report. I wouldn't study in case I wouldn't be as good as I might have to be if I put it all on the line. I didn't finish anything. The cost of alcoholism is not being able to have a life. It's not being able to use your gift. Most of us never got the gift out of the box to get a chance to learn what your gift was, much less play it in the orchestra. Not too long after that psychologist, I'm home. I had the worst day in AA. Got up late, got to work late, left early, got a backgammon game, won $600, got in a fight with my wife and slapped one of the kids. One of those days you'd like to have videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years can do. And I'm in my living room, and I said, "Gee, it happened again." I said, "What do you mean? Weren't you there? It's your life." I say, "Well, yeah, but it's so habitual that it's almost like I go into a blackout. I'm not attending." And all of a sudden I realized that was a bunch of crap. My life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was. I sounded like a guy who wanted to quit gambling. I wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble for as much money as I wanted to gamble, and I had problems because of gambling. I wanted my wife and children's love without spending time with them. I wanted money without work. Not a very good design. And that night, out of fear of being who I was, I got down on my knees. I realized that I had tried as hard as I knew how to try to clean my act up, and I had failed. And for some reason, I was given the idea that that was okay. First time ever. And I got a sense. I got down on my knees, took the sixth and the seventh step. The sixth step said they were entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. The seventh step said we humbly ask to remove our shortcomings. I had tried to get rid of my shortcomings. I don't have the power. I'm responsible. But I am the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. I take certain actions and I start to get ready, and God removes my defects of character. I believe that there is no, that change is so much easier than we would ever believe it to be. And then what I've made a discovery in the last number of years is how afraid of change we are. What I've discovered is that, you know, a doctor doesn't heal, he creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow, he plants a seed, creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place, and God grows, and we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes us. That atmosphere is one of spiritual awakening. What happens to us over a period of time is we become more awake. When you become awake, you don't do things that you did in your sleep. I have spent much of my life asleep. I spent significant time in my marriage asleep, significant times in my parenting asleep, significant time at work asleep. And over a period of time, as you place these steps in your life, you start to wake up. The steps aren't just something that you do. This is really big book country, and a lot of this I don't have to explain, but I'll tell you something. There's a lot of people out there who have memorized the menu, who are trying to eat it and are dying of malnutrition. Anybody can memorize 164 pages. No one owns it. It isn't as black and white. It isn't as clear. Those are directions. I understand it. But I get tired of people who got 8 years of sobriety that sound like they can sit you down and just tell you exactly what to do. I've been doing this for 35 years, baby. And I've been doing it pretty hard and pretty steady. No one knows exactly what to do. Life is not predictable. There is no formula. The path of the steps and the path of the book is to take us to God. The answer is not the book. The book is the vehicle that brings us to the answer. When the master points to the moon, all the idiot sees is the finger. There are people who are talking to you about the menu all the time, and if all you do is the menu, you're going to die of malnutrition. The steps are not mechanical. They are spiritual. There is a way. There isn't just something about doing. There is a way of being and taking the steps. I see a lot of people doing a hell of a lot of step work without much change. There's a difference between activity and action. The steps are something about spiritual action. I promote taking the steps poorly rather than not at all. I have taken them poorly much of my life. They are my spiritual practice. I take them ongoingly. Sometimes I take them, but as a period of time over a lifetime, they become part of who you are. The steps are a change in who you be and what, not what you, you know, and out of who you, when you change who you are, what you do automatically changes. Stuff just falls off of you. It doesn't take effort. It takes awakening. A lot of the pain that most of us experience, one of the things I was talking to Don P. about this afternoon, a couple of other guys, one of the great joys when you come into Alcoholics Anonymous is that you discover that you're not alone, that you find a group of people that are unique, that have the same problem you got. One of the things you need to discover as you get sober is that you're not alone as a human being, that most of the problems we have are not unique to drunks. And that opens up some field of spiritual search for us that a lot of us don't go to because Bill didn't write it. Well, thank God Bill didn't have that hang up, and thank God Bob didn't have that hang up, and thank God those men were directed and read that their libraries on spiritual books were well developed and very broad. And in the process, what has been wrong with me most of my life is I have the same angst that most human beings have. It's not okay, and I'm not okay. I don't know where that came from. I believe that we have the same angst every human being has, but we feel it stronger. Or I don't know, but or that we are so raw that we need relief from it more than someone else does. And then when we ran into the thing that brought us relief, we got a synergistic effect, and that seemed like it brought us an answer for a period of time, and our answer eventually became a problem and almost killed us. The problem for all of us is the answer to that is what you hear a lot of guys in AA talk about, or a lot of gals in AA, it's a God-sized hole. I don't have much time, so rather than just cut through all the BS, it's a God-sized hole. The problem with most of us is the world's saying, you just need younger women, more money, faster horses, bigger cars, bigger houses, bigger jobs, you know, to be cool. You want to be okay? You need this. We have a society guaranteed to make us feel bad. It's designed to make us feel bad. It's not funny. We have advertising today is literally in magazines and television and movies is to say, if you don't look like this, if you don't have this, if you're not doing this, you are not okay. If you don't have a spiritual centered, if you don't have a spiritual message, you're going to become what you fill yourself full of. What you fill yourself full of is what's out there. The answer is not out there. The answer is internal. One of the great blessings we have is we've been given a practice. I don't know where you could go to get the depth of spirituality with the practicality that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know where you could go to see the miracles and the changes that we see on a regular basis. It is just awesome. But to bring that, you need an honesty, a humility, an openness that's hard to maintain. Because the answer is surrender. That's the answer. I mean, everybody wants to come over to the house. They give you that half hour worth of crap that their life's not working. They want to know what to do. You tell them to be quiet, and you say, pretend I just came to you with the same problem. They can tell you what to do. We always know what to do because we have a knower. We just can't do it. We are so afraid of change, we equate it like dying. Scott Peck wrote a book called Further Along a Road Less Traveled, and that he has a chapter called Road to Omaha about death and dying, and talks about the five stages of death and dying that live with Kubler-Ross, talks about denial, anger, bargaining, depression and acceptance, and you know that you go through and you get the diagnosis, you deny it, and you go, you know. And he said, interestingly enough, we think that people who are dying go through those five stages, but they don't. They go through denial, anger, and bargaining, but when they get to the depression, the pain's too great that they go back and recycle in denial, anger, and bargaining because they can't handle the pain of depression. But then he says, but if you allow depression to do its work, I'm not playing doctor here. I'm not talking about clinical depression. I'm talking about appropriate depression due to circumstances in our lives, which the purpose of depression is to grind your ego to dust. Because if the stepstone of change is pain, the benefit of that is that it grinds our ego to dust and opens us up to things, to face things that we are unable and unwilling to face when our ego is in charge and intact. It seems to be that there has to be a crack or a reduction in ego for us to be willing to be able to stand in face of the truth. The truth will set you free. Well, first it will piss you off and scare you and embarrass you, and it's going to be very difficult to stand in front of it. But if you're going to be a person in a spiritual path, if you're going to be wanting a spiritual awakening, if you're going to be a spiritual warrior, it is all about standing in front of places that scare you. It is about the courage to tell the truth. Thank you for this weekend.